bureaucracy, the White House and Department of Homeland Security will need to support TSA leader John Pistol. Kip Hawley spoke to CBS this morning following yesterday's congressional hearing on airline security.
The White House and DHS has got to decide whether they want to have John Pistol make some changes or whether they want to stand behind him. But right now, they're leaving him hanging out by himself.
Some lawmakers say that more than 10 years after the 9/11 attacks, the time's come to relax rules against carrying items such as razors and pocket knives onto planes. Some even suggest weapons should be allowed on planes to fight terrorists, something Pistol labeled a non-starter. And Pistol said there are strong concerns about allowing knives on planes. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created to do what Andrew Carnegie called real and permanent good, celebrating 100 years of philanthropy.
Did you know that you can support WILL without sacrificing income that you may need during your lifetime? Leave your own legacy for the future of this station. Join the Legacy Circle visionaries who have provided a gift through their estate. You are an essential part of our future. For more information, call Donda Beard at 217-333-7300 or online at will.illinois.edu/support.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives. So as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. It's been more than 60 years since the publication of Ayn Rand's novel, The Fountainhead. Yet that book, and the one that followed, Atlas Shrugged, continued to be very strong sellers. And some people project that this year we could see a very big spike in interest in and purchases of those books. Back in 1998, a poll conducted by the Modern Library put these two books at the top of the list of the greatest novels of the 20th century. And many people have said that they felt that was these books, one of the two, both of them, or some of the most influential books on them personally that they had ever read. Why is it that the ideas of Ayn Rand continue to have this kind of power to move so many people? Well, that's one of the questions we'll try and take up this morning as we talk with Anne Heller. She's the author of a newly published biography that's titled Ayn Rand and the World She Made. It is published by Nan Talese. The book is out now. And we'll talk about who Ayn Rand was, about her formative years growing up in Russia, how that influenced her thinking, and how she went on to influence the thinking of a lot of people. Our guest, Anne Heller, is a magazine editor and journalist. She has been managing editor of the Antioch Review, fiction editor at Esquire and Red Book, and features editor of Lear's. She also served as executive editor of the magazine development group at Condé Nast Publications, with a special emphasis on money and finance. Ms. Heller, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
I'm very pleased to be here, David.
If I asked you to, in a few sentences, to distill the essential ideas of Ayn Rand, or the thing that was right at the core of her philosophy, could you do that?
I think I could. She said that every man has a right to live for himself, that each man's or woman's life is an end in itself, that nobody has a right to interfere with the natural rights of individuals, and that capitalism is the only economic system or political system, as she thought, that supports individual liberties and depends on individual rights to function.
So it's very clear, obviously, and certainly if you read about her or you read her work, that she places the individual at the center of everything.
At the center of the universe, absolutely.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that you've said, and perhaps this explains something of her appeal for people, and maybe would explain something of her charismatic power to draw people near her. One of the facts about her was that it seemed that she did not have even the tiniest shred of doubt about herself and about what she believed.
Everyone that I talked to, and I talked to many, many people who knew her, say that that was one of the most attractive magnetic things about her, that she was so certain of her ideas and that her ideas were knitted together in a way that made the world make perfect sense to her and to others. And it was very reassuring to people to find in one woman an answer to all their questions.
Yeah, and that that seemed, that kind of attraction seemed enough to outweigh the fact that she, for people who were close to her and people who were in her circle, she could be quite callous and cruel in the way that she treated them. And in spite of that, people really were very drawn to her and very attached to her.
They wanted to stay near her. She grew harsher, more judgmental, more demanding as she grew older. And the people who gathered around her in the 1950s didn't see that part of her so apparently as they did later. But even later, when she was very intolerant and could be very cruel, people longed to be part of her universe. She'd written these wonderful novels, so they thought, and I think too, in which she created a world that was meant for the gifted, the ambitious, the engaged personality, and people wanted to feel that they were part of that world.
Yeah.
And I think that's true of people who read her books as well. They see in Howard Roark and John Galt and her other heroes a way out of conventionality, expectations of the world around them, their parents, their teachers. These books especially appeal to young people, but they appeal to all of us. It's sort of the rebel in all of us.
Yeah. It's very striking, as I mentioned, that now all these many years later, the Fountainhead was published in 1943, and Atlas Shrugged was published in 1957. These books have continued to sell quite respectably year after year in six figures, and apparently also some people are projecting that this year, for reasons maybe obvious, that we could see a very big spike in sales of these books.
That's true. The books do have sold sort of sub rosa year after year. People read them, talk about them, but they don't appear much in the news until last year when we had our financial crisis and our financial meltdown, and the government began to play a more active role in our economy again. And Atlas Shrugged is all about what happens when the government plays an active role in an economy that Ayn Rand felt should be absolutely laissez-faire, free market dealings, a trader mentality. And she predicted a kind of doom that comes from government interference in the economy, as well as in the lives of individual people in a nation. And people are looking to that to see whether there's anything they can learn.
And I suppose if she was with us today, she would say, you see? You see? This is what I was talking about right here. And I think it's also interesting that her popularity and the sales of her book really have been sustained in spite of the fact that reviews of her writing mostly were not kind, and that as well among, certainly among academic philosophers, economists, political scientists, people—
literary critics.
None of those people, none of those sorts of, we'll put it in quotes, establishment kind of figures ever really thought much of her, and some of the things that they said about her were extremely harsh. In spite of that, she's managed to maintain this kind of very consistent level of popularity.
In fact, I think you could say in part because of it. Critics were so nasty and unforgiving about her work and accused her of everything from Nazism to Satanism that those who found some value in her work felt that they were under siege along with her. And so it became a kind of us and them situation, which always, always fuels loyalty by those who feel that they're being attacked.
Yeah. And I mean, to be fair, I guess I would say that I've only read excerpts of the books. And I'm not sure what sort of word I would use to describe her writing. Maybe I'll just not do that. The thing, though, I think that she might say was that maybe she wasn't so much thinking that she was creating great literature or that she was creating fully realized characters. I think for her, the purpose of the books and the purpose of the characters was to deliver her words. So maybe she really didn't care whether they were complete characters. They were there to deliver, to make the speeches that she wrote for them.
You know, it would be convenient to think so because her characters are wooden and her plots are to some degree unrealistic, to quite a large degree. But she thought she was creating great literature, and she thought that the heroes particularly, but the villains too in her novels, were real people. She lived with them, and they were in some ways realer to her than the people who surrounded her in real life. And interestingly enough, the force of her personality was such that the people who became her followers and her cult also felt that way, that her characters were the most real things in the world.
She certainly was a strong woman, and there are women characters in the books. I think one of the things that to me that is very striking is that her ideal hero is, in fact, male. And the strongest characters, I think, the people who really move things in the books are men. And for that reason, I guess I wonder what women readers, particularly women readers today, make of gender relations in her books. I don't think that you could say that they were progressive.
There are ongoing arguments about that subject. People point to Dagny Taggart, who's the heroine of Atlas Shrugged and who is the main consciousness through which we see the action in Atlas Shrugged, as a feminist hero. She's the vice president of a railway. She really runs the railroad while her brother kind of sulks and appeases people. And she's seen by some as a feminist heroine. Rand herself felt that men and women had absolutely equal rights, but that men were better. She considered herself a hero worshiper, and the heroes in her novels are men that she more or less fell in love with as she wrote about them. And she does not respect any woman who doesn't put the man in her life first. And she said that many times. She even said that she would object to a woman president of the United States on the basis that that woman would not be a real woman because she put herself above men.
Hmm. Certainly in her personal life, she didn't put her husband first.
No, she did not. She didn't put anybody first. In fact, she chose a husband who I think everybody felt was the loveliest man in the world, but quite unaggressive, gentle, and willing to do whatever he needed to do to support her on his behalf. I should say that he thought she was an extremely talented person and that she deserved support. But she didn't really consult him about that. She just expected him to do what was best for her. And in middle life, she took a young lover, fellow 25 years younger than she was, and who was madly in love with her writing and her philosophy. In some ways, one could consider him to fill the role of a mistress for a successful, wealthy author.
Mm. And then when he, sometime into this relationship, met and fell in love with somebody else, someone who was maybe a little bit more age-appropriate, she threw him out of her world.
All hell broke loose. She didn't expect it. It's just astonishing that at the age of 63, I think she was, when they finally broke up, he was 38. It had been 14 years of active sexual attachment. She was surprised and outraged that he would want somebody else. She thought her philosophy dictated that a man should want the most gifted, strongest woman he could find. And that woman was always Ayn Rand. Mm. So she not only excommunicated him, she excommunicated from her cult. anybody who had anything nice to say about him. And by the middle 70s, the entire objectivist movement, which is what she called her movement, had broken in half and splintered and drifted away.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Ann Heller. She's the author of a newly published biography of Ayn Rand. The title of the book is Ayn Rand and the World She Made. It's published by Nantelis. We have a caller here. Others are certainly welcome to call, ask questions, make comments. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. The caller here is in Urbana, line one. Hello?
Oh, hi.
Yes?
Mr. Heller. Thank you. I was looking through the New York Times review of your book and the other one, the simultaneous book publishing of books about her. And I'm curious as to, it's interesting that her books still sell because I read them when I was in my 20s. And I thought they were, I liked the idea of the individual, but I thought her notions about capitalism, since they were written pretty early in the 50s, I think, were a little naive in the sense that modern culture is so technically and economically complex that I don't think you can have it function very well without governmental interference. And I know, excuse me, one other thing. I would like you to talk about her Hollywood days because I think those are influential in her books in the way and I think I agree with the critics of her books. Her characters are cardboard, flat, and uninteresting. Her idea—they're just carriers of her ideas, which I think are also specious now, in considering how complex society is. I mean, we have nuclear reactors and all these unbelievable complex chemicals and genetic engineering. She didn't even know anything about when she wrote these books. So, could you comment?
Yes, I think you might be being a little too hard on her literary achievements. Some of her characters are flat. Her heroes tend to be less interesting than her villains, in my opinion. But she's got some great characters in her books, particularly in Atlas Shrugged. She deals with every level of the social order. And the people who don't behave well, according to Ayn Rand, are often filled with great personality and malicious motives, and they're Dickensian characters. They're characters from melodrama. So she needs to be given a little bit of credit for that. Mm-hmm. As to capitalism, I couldn't agree with you more, but she, being a Russian, mm-hmm. Posited an extreme form, an almost utopian form of her ideas, against which I think people in general find it useful to push off and find out where they stand. It's often good to consult the extremes to find out where the middle is. Mm-hmm. So although I agree with you that she's not useful as a visionary or a prophet or a social designer, I think she is useful as a social critic, and that's where I find the value in Ayn Rand.
Yeah. Well, also a Hollywood thing, but one other thing. There's in the reviews, I know that she had an amphetamine addiction later in life, and do you think that had? I mean, this whole thing about her ego, which is real important in your book, and important about her because she was, you know, self-centered, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's about her more than anything else. Which, of course, if you're a very successful life, she was, and very well known and sort of worshipped. I guess we get to go to your head. What do you think the amphetamines did to her later on? And I'll hang up. And also, could you talk about her Hollywood days? I think those are real important.
Thank you. We'll definitely do that. Maybe you can go to the other question though. The caller asked.
Which question?
I mean about her amphetamine use.
Yes, she began to use amphetamines in about 1942, as she was finishing The Fountainhead, and you can really see the difference in her handwriting in the manuscripts of the Library of Congress. The handwriting speeds up, and the mistakes are gone. There are no more, you know, very few cross-outs and things. And she continued to take those amphetamines until the 1970s, when she was told by a doctor that she had to stop. There's a great debate about how much she took and whether she just took two pills a day according to the doctor's prescription or whether she took more. It seems evident to me from the interviews I conducted and, you know, the things I learned that she took amphetamines to stay up all night, to finish deadlines, and the use of amphetamines over a long period of time, and particularly in high doses, can lead to a lot of personality distortions, anger, paranoia, things that she exhibited even without amphetamine use. So I think amphetamines did contribute to some of the personality changes that she showed over the many years that she was writing.
I want to, just for a moment here, because I think it's important to understanding her ideas and where they came from, just to talk, have you talk a little bit about her her youth. She was born in St. Petersburg in Russia, and she was 12 at the time of the Russian Revolution. And this was something that she and her family lived through. Her family certainly suffered at the hands of the Bolsheviks. And what she saw was a country that was really where everyone, she, her family, everyone really, the city where she grew up, were all broken and impoverished by the revolution. She saw what she thought was, you know, the government's intrusion into people's everyday lives, the government's failure to provide for people's basic needs. So she clearly saw this as the failure of the big state, no matter what the political ideology was. So that's not only where her ardent anti-communism comes from, but also her feeling that big government couldn't do anything right. That's where also where that comes from. And those things were stayed with her for all of her life.
That's correct. That's absolutely right. She also identified communism in particular and any form of socialism or collectivism or even liberal economic policies as punishing the rich, which she considered, according to her own 19th century mindset, as the productive people in society, and rewarding those who were not productive. And she saw that as a very bad thing. I think there's, you know, there's lots to argue about that, but she hated collectivism because she saw her father, who had worked so hard to become a middle, a bourgeois, a member of the bourgeoisie, have in one day have his entire life taken away from him. They shuttered his pharmacy doors and took away his building that he just bought and gave what he had to laborers who she felt had not worked so hard nor worked so hard to be educated and so on and so forth. So she saw that as a matter of basic injustice, taking from one person to give to another person without the assent of the person who was being taken from.
Were there other thinkers that were particularly, and I'm thinking particularly of this formative period, say when she would have been in high school or when she would have been in university when she was still in Russia, thinkers, writers, people who were very important for her?
She loved Victor Hugo. She loved the romanticism, the larger-than-life scope of his novels. I think his novels explained a lot to her about the French Revolution and therefore about the Russian Revolution. And she loved Aristotle. She studied comparative philosophy in university in St. Petersburg. And at first she was attracted to Plato because she thought that he was, you know, looking for the good and so on and so forth. But then she realized that he was that Plato was locating what was good in some nether world that didn't really exist. And she found that frightening in the same way that she found Russian Orthodox Christianity frightening, and the idea that the state tells you, sacrifice today and tomorrow it will be better, frightening. So she latched onto Aristotle, who was a very, you know, is a very realistic, practical philosopher, and read him and used his thinking in her own philosophy. Those were the two thinkers and writers she admitted having been influenced by. There were lots of others, I think, more minor players who she didn't talk about, but who she was certainly influenced by, like H.L. Mencken and, you know, Nietzsche and very much Nietzsche and many others.
I think of Nietzsche, she said something like, with maybe some small bit of annoyance and humor, that she said something like, he beat me to some of my best ideas, something like that.
Yes, that was Ayn Rand in a nutshell.
Yeah. And she, just one more question. She was born Alyssa Rosenbaum. When did she become Ayn Rand, and where did she get that name from?
There's some debate about that, too. There's some debate about almost everything concerning Ayn Rand's youth. She said that she had chosen Ayn from, that it was a Finnish name, and that it was the name of a Finnish writer. And then at another time she said that that she'd made it up herself. And about Rand, she said a number of things. She took the name on her way to America, or just before she came to America. It was a pseudonym. She felt she needed, I think, it's safe to say, a non-Jewish name to succeed as a writer and a thinker in the United States in the 1920s. It was still a period of anti-Semitism here, as well as in Europe. And she, I think she wanted not a female name, not an ethnic name, a name that would disguise her from the Soviet authorities when she outstayed her visa, which she planned to do from the beginning, and that might protect her parents from repercussions when she wrote her anti-communist books, which she intended to do from the very beginning, too. So I think her name, Ayn, came from a pet name that her father had for her. He called her Ayanuchka, which means kind of bright eyes in a kind of Yiddish, in a Hebrew diminutive. And if that's the case, and I have no proof for it except that I know he called her that, it's rather sweet. I think she loved her father very much.
Our guest is Ann Heller. She's the author of a newly published biography of Ayn Rand. The title of the book is Ayn Rand and the World She Made. It's published by Nan Talese, out now. One of two books, interestingly enough, now just new biographies of Ayn Rand that are out now. Questions are welcome. We have some people ready to go. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Next in line is Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hello, good morning.
Yes.
First off, Mr. Inge, for shame, having never read Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. Oh, naughty, naughty, naughty.
It's just one of the list of books that probably I should have read, but never did.
Yep.
It's not too late.
Yes. my questions are, what's going on these days with Ayn Rand's intellectual heir, Leonard Peikoff? And what do you think, to reference one of her lesser-known books, We the Living, how much of that, the feminine character in We the Living, was at least romantically, perhaps in her eyes, based on Ayn Rand's life? I mean, I assume she didn't, obviously she wasn't killed trying to get across the border, so on and so forth. She got out of Russia somehow, legally and so forth. But comment on that, if you would, please.
Okay, to take the second question first, We the Living is a fabulous book. She published it 10 years after she arrived in the United States, having had to learn English to write it. And it is very much autobiographical. Kira is a year older than Ayn Rand was in the book, and she has some of the characteristics of a boyfriend that Ayn Rand had as a youth, and some of the characteristics of Ayn Rand. And I spend a good deal of time in the book tracing the differences and some of the similarities, because I think it's very illuminating about who Ayn Rand was when she left the Soviet Union and who she became. Remind me of the second question. The first question. I'm so sorry.
He mentioned a particular person, and it was not a familiar name.
Oh, Leonard Peikoff.
Leonard Peikoff,
yes.
who is someone who was apparently one of the people in her circle.
Yes, Leonard Peikoff was the last real follower who remained with Ayn Rand after that, that debacle that took place in the late 60s and early 70s. He was a professor of philosophy. He's remained entirely devoted to Ayn Rand, as far as I know. But I must say, he is not her intellectual heir. Nathaniel Brandon, who was her lover, was named her intellectual heir. And when he betrayed her, as she thought, sexually, she disinherited him and never named another intellectual heir. Leonard Peikoff is the heir to her estate, her copyrights, her papers. But in spite of being called as her intellectual heir, he's not. Apart from that, I don't know very much about him. I think he's living in California. I think he's divorced from his third wife. He has a daughter. He hasn't been well over the years. I don't know what the state of his health is now. I don't think that he appears much in public, but I might be wrong about that. I'm in New York and don't always get the word when he's appearing in the West Coast.
All right, let's go on. Talk with someone here where we are in Champaign County. This is Line 3. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, I read it in high school, and I don't remember how it was passed to me, but it was certainly circulating, and I think it was a time when I was a voracious reader of science fiction, and the characters in that are kind of wooden. I think maybe adolescent is another term, and maybe that's just because that's when I read it, I suppose, but enough autobiography, but her atheism, you mentioned it earlier, coming from, you know, the godless communist scourge, for her to, I guess she was really alienated from the Orthodox Church in Russia or something. I don't understand. In the 50s, that would have been, and for people like the former Fed chair and people like that to have sort of espoused that is pretty, to use an awkward word, countercultural at the time, I think. But
yeah.
So I wanted you to expand on that something. But I'm just reflecting on it. Atlas Shrugged is sort of a strike by the productive, quote unquote, productive upper class, sort of the doers and movers and shakers. And it just seems to me that this virulent anti-unionism that was rampant and that she was included in, I mean, what's the matter with other people withholding their labor or their productive capacity? It just seems to me that the idea that any collectivism was completely ruled out because of her experiences being disenfranchised in Russia is just anyway, that's in Kuwait, but I'd like you to respond to those perhaps generally 2 points if you could.
Her atheism, let me start with that. She was disliked by post-war conservatives for her atheism, and Whitaker Chambers, in fact, compared her to Marx in her materialism and atheism. But what she would have said is that both communism and Christianity are based on altruism, which is to say putting something or someone else ahead of the self and deriving one's sense of value not from one's own life, but from the duty or debt one owes to others. And she found that unacceptable. And she felt that, she said in a letter, in fact, to her friend Isabel Patterson, that if God exists, God is a dictator. And she said to Patterson, oh, you say he doesn't use his power? Well, never mind. He's got it. If he's God, he's a dictator. And she didn't like that idea. And, of course, the post-war right, which was quite a religious movement with William Buckley and Whitaker Chambers and those guys didn't like her for her atheism. They felt, and with some, I think this is really interesting, they felt that her characters had to be great heroes and better than life, bigger than life and better than life. Because given her philosophy, if they were just normal people, their selfishness would quickly degenerate into greed and cheating, and there would be very little honor or integrity if they weren't bigger than life. So it's an interesting question. Again, I would have to say that that the case that she makes is interesting in itself. You know, we may not like it, but it's interesting to read about. Now, What was the other?
Well, I'm glad the caller raised this question, because he was talking about this sort of central idea, or the thing that moves the plot in Atlas Shrugged, the fact that these people that she considered to be the creative class, that included both artists but also the kind of barons of industry that were her, you know, her heroes, these people decide they're the ones who are being exploited. They're being exploited by the government. They're being exploited by the workers. So they decide, okay, we're going to go on strike.
Yes.
And they disappear, and the idea is without these people, then society, you know, falls apart.
Exactly.
And I think, though, a lot of people would look at that and say, what? These people think they're being exploited? And it just seems to me odd that this kind of thing would take such hold now, when it seems to be there is so much anger that's directed at these kinds of people, at least people who are the movers and shakers of big business.
Yes, she would not defend these particular movers and shakers. The movers and shakers who accept government handouts and are ready to do anything to, you know, stay in business after they've ruined themselves and everybody else would be villains in her books. It's, you know, Ayn Rand was not afraid to be accused of using a gimmick to make a point. And in a sense, this reversal of this, you know, this strike idea from labor to the industrialists and the inventors and the engineers and the people that, you know, she admired, I think it's partly as a Russian, she admired these productive people, the inventors, is, you know, in some ways a gimmick to make a point. And I think that has to be kept in mind.
Was there ever anyone, an actual real person, that she would have pointed to and say, here is the real life embodiment of the, you know, here, this is the real John Galt? You know?
I think she would have said Andrew Carnegie, or you know, some of the late 19th century builders of empires and fortunes, who didn't do it by moving money around on a computer, but by actually building things. I think that her idea of America was rooted in the late 19th century and the early 20th century, when she came here from a place where there was nothing. It was absolutely impoverished, and St. Petersburg, of course, was built 300 years earlier, and nothing had been built since then. And she came here and she saw airplanes flying overhead and cars on the road and skyscrapers going up and people having a gay time in the theater and music. And she thought, this is the result of the work of people like Carnegie and the others. Hmm.
And I just happened to be listening to another of the interviews that you did about the book, and the interviewer asked you, I think he said, well, what do you think that Ayn Rand would have thought of Bill Gates? And you said, oh, I actually think that Ayn Rand would have hardly approved of Bill Gates.
I do. I think so. He did it on his own, and he created something that had never been, that we'd never had before, that has created great wealth for a number of people, and that was her view of a capitalist. Somebody who through the, you know, the creation of something new made himself rich and raised the level of living standard for everybody else.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Ann Heller. She is a magazine editor and journalist and is the author of a new biography of Ayn Rand. The title of the book is Ayn Rand and the World She Made. Let's talk again with another caller, and we'll go next to line one in Champaign. Hello.
Morning.
Yes.
Like many people of my ilk, I find Ayn Rand to be pernicious to the society and absurd as a philosopher. But you speak of her intellectual heritage, and I'm wondering, especially with Greenspan, we mentioned that review that was in the Times, to what extent do you think that these people honestly think that her thinking and her analysis of society is profound or meaningful, or to what extent do you think it really, the Ayn Rand phenomenon is really just an expression of, like, their having some pretense towards some intellectual or social analysis that portrays the people on top as, like, legitimately on top and, like, what a wonderful world it is. And my tradition interjected, anyone who thinks Andrew Carnegie was a good thing for human history. Doesn't recollect his labor practices whatsoever.
Absolutely. She had a very romantic view of things. To treat her as a, this is my view, to treat her as a practical thinker, or somebody from whom we can derive hints about how to live, is to miss the chance to actually benefit from reading her. So I agree with you that taken straight, she's pernicious. And in answer to, but, you know, she shouldn't be taken straight. That would be silly. That's my view. In answer to the other question about Alan Greenspan, I was shocked to hear his speech before the Congress last October when he said, gee, I seem to have been wrong about businessmen being honorable. I seem to have been wrong to think that they would regulate themselves because they had their own long-term best interest at heart. And I was wrong to think that they wouldn't be greedy because that would mean their businesses would fail if they didn't serve the customer correctly, and so on and so forth. He was talking about something he had written 45 years ago for Ayn Rand, and something that she had taught him that I could not believe that he still believed. But I have to take him at his word that he was disappointed and horrified to find out that what he had thought all his life and what Ayn Rand had taught him seemed not to be true. Others, I think, you know, with any kind of cult, and Ayn Rand did have a cult, and she still has one, people cling to it because it gives them a sense of who they are and of belonging. So I think some people are sincere in their, in their belief that her philosophy is useful, and some people are not, just like anything else.
Just the name of Alan Greenspan has come up several times in the conversation, and I'm glad we finally got around to talking about him, because probably of all of the, he's the most, at least that I can think of, that always comes up, the most high-profile, most influential person who seems to have been heavily influenced by her.
Yes.
And that then leads to this question, do you really think that have there been some important ways, do you think, that her thinking influenced American politics or policymaking within the government?
I absolutely do. Greenspan is famous for saying that Ayn Rand put the moral basis under the moral floor under capitalism for him. He says that before he met her, he thought that, you know, that our system of our economic system, as it was just the best of some bad choices. After getting to know her, he thought that that it was the only moral system and that it was a positive good because of the whole individual rights question, you know, where we own, capitalism depends on the ownership of property. It depends on the free trade of goods in a marketplace, and depends on freedoms that other economic systems don't. And I think that explanation, that justification of capitalism, has had a huge effect on bolstering the pro-capitalist forces and muting the more liberal elements in our society.
All right, let's talk with another caller. Line 2, Champaign.
Okay, can you hear me okay?
Yes, go ahead.
I got in late on this. I have a million and one comments, but just in relationship to what you last said, there's been one article after another in the liberal publication America by... Jesuit publication, and I believe Commonweal, like another liberal Catholic publication, under attacking her her justifications of capitalism.
Oh, I didn't know that article.
And the last year or so, year and a half, there's one article. Actually, she's often mentioned. But a number of comments, see if I can all tie them all together. Her short story, The Little Street, where she praises, I believe, William Hickman, it's mentioned in your book.
Oh, it's horrible, yeah.
Yeah, I kind of want to tie that in to the fact that she's something of an intellectual inspiration for, here we go off on the far side, Anton LaVey, I'm sure you've heard of Anton LaVey, the founder of the rather atheistic Church of Satan. It's not they're not devil worshippers so much as just a hedonistic, atheistic organization. But I want to tie that into the fact that he praised Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker, and he praised another mass murderer, James Huber T. And just disgusting, okay. And her comments on John Kennedy, comparing him to Hitler, that's disgusting. It seems to be that anyone that has a touch or a tinge of collectivism, that she, you know, puts in a category with Hitler and Stalin and so forth. And
yeah, let's get. Well, you've given us. We're getting really short on time.
I have maybe one other.
I'm sorry.
I'll let you go.
Very good.
We'll
that gives us something to chew over. What do you think?
I think there's a whole lot of anger and hatred in Ayn Rand. The Little Street, which she wrote in 1928 after she'd been here for 2 years, is an ugly document about the spiritual superiority of a young man who has killed and dismembered an 11-year-old girl in Los Angeles. Now, she doesn't. This is a fictionalization of that event, but the point of it is to hate the society in which her character, the murderer, finds himself as being, you know, fat and sloppy and not disciplined and just hateful characterizations of people. And I think that it's important to know that Ayn Rand wrote that and felt that and said that straightforwardly in her youth, because I don't think that changed all that much over her life. Mm.
I guess that, you know, for me, that the thing that I find sort of disturbing or concerning, I guess, about her is this, the cult of the charismatic individual. And where that can and has led, and elevating the individual over everything. I guess myself, I'm not sure that that's particularly healthy for anybody, either for the individual or for society.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree with you there. I think I'm a proponent of the social contract myself, and. You know, she's not a delectable creature in any way, shape, or form, but she does state really clearly. No one could state it more clearly. A strain in American thinking and in our I don't know whether to say our national instincts or what, but. That it's a good idea to pay attention to.
We try and get one more caller here. Bloomington, Illinois, on our line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hello.
Yes.
Thank you for a wonderful program. Sorry. I missed the part about Leonard Peacock. I guess is all that in your book? And the other question thing is that haunting, I can't remember the name of it, where the woman goes out in the woods in the snow in her wedding gown.
Yes.
Oh, my God. You can bet I'll read the other books after hearing you. Whatever happened to Lears? That's what I like, that wonderful magazine.
yes, Lears ended after. Lears was a magazine founded by Frances Lear, who was the ex-wife of Norman Lear. Mm-hmm. After her divorce, she came to New York and started a magazine for women over the age of 40, whose tagline was "For the Woman Who Wasn't Born Yesterday." And it lasted for 5 years, and then it closed because the advertising support just faded away.
That was a wonderful magazine. But is the rest in your book about the her personal life? You mentioned, I missed that part, separating from her husband. And
yes, it's all in there. And I just want to say that one of the purposes of the book that I wrote was to test just how well Ayn Rand's philosophy played out in her own life. And without making any overt judgments, I think that the answer is there.
She, as I mentioned a little bit earlier in the interview, there right now there are two new biographies of Rand out, and the you were not given the opportunity that the other author had really to have access to her personal papers. So apparently the people now who guard her image and her and the materials weren't exactly sure what you were up to, I guess, or at least they had a better idea what the other author would do, and maybe they thought they would be happier. Have you gotten some sort of a feedback from people who are
yes.
think that they're looking after her image, and what do they think of the book?
I haven't found out what they think of my book. I have been told that she was, the other author was a graduate student when she approached the archive, and they do let some graduate students look around. I think she was probably not planning a publishable book at that point. I've also been told that that the archive did not consider what she was doing a biography, but rather a study of Rand's ideas in the late 20th century particularly, although there's some biographical material in there. I think the fact that I was planning from the start to write a publishable biography to be published by a major publishing house made them leery of me, and they're generally leery. I'm not sure they're happy about either book at this point, but I think that this all of this publicity has embarrassed the Ayn Rand Institute enough that they're formalizing and probably changing their policies a bit about this.
Well, I think no matter what one thinks of her writing or her ideas, she certainly was a fascinating character. And if you would like to read more about her life, and I must apologize to the caller, we did not get even to talk about her going to Hollywood. That's an amazing story, how she goes to Hollywood and comes under the wing of Cecil B. DeMille.
Yes, it is.
She's just had a really amazing life. So I guess I would say to people, you want to read more? Well, you look for this book that we've talked about, Ayn Rand and the World She Made. It's just out, published by Ann Talese, by our guest, Anne Heller. And Ms. Heller, well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Many of our past shows, along with local news features, are available on our website. Anytime that you're ready to listen, just go to will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue, so please stay tuned.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the City of Urbana, presenting Urbana's Market at the Square. The market opens at 7 a.m. featuring Illinois-grown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods and food, and original works of art at the corner of Illinois and Vine Streets in downtown Urbana. Information online at urbanaillinois.us/market.
Job growth is slower, but some entrepreneurs are still hiring.
This year we hired 2 more technicians, and we hope to hire 1 more.
Still, with economic turmoil in Europe and Congress facing a fiscal cliff, there's plenty to be concerned about.
We as a small business have been very careful as to how we spend our money.
Hiring with Caution, today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where at mid-session, U.S. corn futures are trading higher in the open outcry. They're being boosted by dry soil in the Corn Belt and worries that continued dry weather could hinder crop development. The strong cash markets are also a supportive factor for nearby futures. Though the weak outside market and a stronger dollar today is limiting gains somewhat. Wheat futures down, wheat being pressured by the ongoing U.S. harvest of winter products, and traders possibly making some spread bets that are short wheat and long corn or soybeans. Let's go ahead and look at some particulars. These are the composite numbers. pit trade plus electronic trade combined. The July wheat at 661.5, down 7. December, 701.25, down 6.25. Those are Kansas City numbers. In Chicago, July wheat, 635.25, down 6.5. December, 677.75, down 4.5. July corn, 603, up 9, now 9.25. September, 550, up 7. December, 543.25, up 6.75. March of 13 at 554.75, up 6.5. May, 562, up 6. July soybeans, 1435.5, up 7.5, now 7 even.